another episode of the Expert Witness Playbook, the podcast where we explore the intersection of medicine, litigation, credibility, and expert testimony. I'm your host, Dr. Brian Woodruff, board-certified pediatric neurologist and medical expert witness. Today's guest is Dr. Joshua Feblowitz, a board-certified emergency medicine physician, healthcare leader, and expert witness consultant serving both plaintiff and defense counsel. Dr. Feblowitz is an associate medical director and vice chair of emergency medicine at Frederick Health Hospital in Maryland, where he helps oversee operations in a high acuity emergency department, seeing approximately 70,000 patient visits annually. In addition to his clinical and operational leadership, he serves as director of content for Full Code Medical, a global virtual simulation and medical education platform used to improve clinical decision-making and physician training. A graduate of Harvard Medical School with residency training through Mass General Brigham, Dr. Feblowitz also earned a master's degree in science writing from MIT, a background that uniquely informs his ability to communicate complex medical issues with clarity and precision. His expert witness work focuses on emergency department evaluation, acute clinical decision-making, diagnostic processes, standard of care, and causation analysis. Combining frontline emergency medicine experience with hospital leadership and education, Dr. Feblowitz brings a practical and balanced perspective to the realities of emergency care and medical litigation. Josh, welcome to the Expert Witness Playbook.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Brian.
Yeah, it's been great getting to meet you over the past few weeks. We've chatted before, and super excited to get a chance to sit down and talk to you about sort of your background. So I think I always like to just start out and just hear people's story of kind of what got them into medicine and what got you into emergency medicine in particular.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. I mean, for me, it was definitely kind of life experience, childhood experience that sort of started me down this path. I was a kid with food allergies and asthma and different issues that had me sometimes in and out of the hospital, sometimes in the emergency department, getting treatment for asthma or an allergic reaction. And, you know, that kind of formative experience was really, it showed me that it was a place to go to heal, that there were people that were always there that could help you and fix the problem that was going on when you were feeling bad. And that kind of really kicked it off for me, you know, specifically my interest in emergency medicine, having those childhood experiences. And so as I went along and developed more of a love for, you know, for science, and I always thought about emergency medicine as the goal at the end of the day, and in large part because of some of those experiences. But once I got into my training and really found a love for just the amount of variety, variability, the fact that every day is very different, very unique, that you meet, you know, so many people from so many walks of life and handle all kinds of different situations, that appealed to me as well. You know, just to be that kind of doctor who's, you know, ready for anything, you know, ready to jump in and train to do that. So it's been great fun, being on that journey over the many years that it does take.
Yeah, fast-paced.
Very much so.
Emergency medicine is fast-paced from what I remember from many years ago, doing a rotation or two. Did you grow up out on the East Coast, or where was home for you?
Yeah, I'm from Boston originally. Yeah, okay. I grew up around Boston, and I was there for, you know, most of my life. Went to school there, got training there, and then moved down to Maryland after residency to practice here. And I've been in a community practice at this point for about 7 years, working out of first Carroll Hospital and then Frederick Hospital now in Frederick, Maryland.
Yeah, I love Boston. My oldest daughter finished up college last year at Washington University in St. Louis, and moved up to Boston, and it's just great to get to visit. It's a great great town. It's not too big to navigate, so it's been
popular. We do miss it. Yeah,
so let's sort of dive in. How long have you been doing expert work? Tell me a little bit about your experience with expert work, because I think You've been doing it for a couple of years now, right?
Yeah, and I really wanted to, have the opportunity to kind of share that journey with others. People that want to start out or want to dive in or not exactly sure how to. I definitely, would not yet call myself an expert at being an expert. I've done it for a few years though now, and have a lot of different types of matters that I've worked on. But I got started the way I think a lot of folks may. I had this notion that it was something I wanted to explore at some point, and I had gotten to a place of clinical practice where I felt like I could branch out and try that out. And then I decided to dive in and see what I could do. And at first it was slow going. And I think that is a very common experience, because you're someone that people don't necessarily know, or and you don't have that experience yet. And then after a little bit of time, got my first case. That specifically in that case was through a referral, a kind of arrangement where the there's a intermediary that refers a case to eligible experts, and then it just built from there. And it over the last couple of years, I really enjoyed doing it, and it's become a regular part of my practice, which really, and it really helps, sharpen and hone your own thinking about your day-to-day practice as well. So over the last 2 years, I've been building up and learning about the space and meeting attorneys, and taking on cases and doing reviews. It's been really enjoyable to build that, that kind of separate practice, to augment and to complement the day-to-day clinical work.
Yeah, a lot of people do. And we all talk about the slow go to start. It's kind of a slog at the beginning because if people don't know you're out there. And so there's all different, we've talked about all different routes where people get known, they contact attorneys, they use referral services, they build a website, they get listed on a directory, they may do an email blast. There's sort of so many different ways. Or get referrals from colleagues and things. So sounds like your start was with one of the many, many referral services that are out there.
No, I've enjoyed doing, obtaining cases in that way. An opportunity to kind of, get ones, through someone else who's pounding the pavement and figuring it out. But I've done a little bit of it, everything that you mentioned, and learned along the way. Just, putting my name out there on a listing, or participating in some of the referral directories, doing some basic advertising with a website or otherwise. And it was certainly for me, that slow start. It was probably about 6 months before I had a first case, and but then it continued to grow over time, and it really does kind of organically grow with as you are known, and known as someone who is objective and solid, reliable, communicative, that gets passed on, and you give get more opportunities.
So a lot of people that listen are new or may have never even received their first case. And what I hear is they want specifics. Can you give more, maybe a little bit more specifics as far as what you think has worked specifically for you to get cases? I think I've heard website, maybe directory. So speaking to those people that haven't even got their first case, what would you say to them if you were sitting across having coffee to them?
So I would say, working with a strong, referral agency is a good option for people that want to break in, or they want to, do it a little bit part time. For me specifically, that's Expert Institute, and there are a number of similar kinds of firms, but there you will encounter different structures out there, and I really favor one where, attorneys are, paying a referral firm, and that referral firm is seeking a really strong expert. There, and the structure is not on you, to pay or to participate, or to have a subscription. It's just to be a strong expert in your field and be selected, and then, the attorney is paying the referral agency. I think, that works the best to me. There are many different kinds of arrangements you'll come across, paid listings or paid directories, situations where people will promote you, but they will, take a portion of fees. off the top or something like that. And I think the cleanest and strongest is to work with the kind of firm that has just a model where they work with the attorneys and then they source you as a strong expert. And I think that works especially well to get started.
I
But I
think
have, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
was going to say to clarify for those that are out there, there's kind of two structures. One is where the attorney is working with the referral service. The referral service finds Dr. Feblowitz, and then that attorney pays the firm a fee, and then you're working directly with the attorney at that point. You're billing directly with the attorney. And that referral service is out of the fold. And the other system I see out there is where all of the financial transactions move through the referral service. So they're taking your rate and either discounting it or adding money on top of it, and then you're billing the referral firm, and then they are taking a certain portion of that of what they bill. I think that's
Exactly.
you've probably seen both of those. I think it's important for people to know that there's kind of two different systems out there.
And I think, you can go and find, what works, best for you. Specifically when we're talking about the referral space, I like it's much cleaner and smoother to just have a partner with the attorney once that search is closed.
Absolutely.
And I really favor that. And then that is what, your organic practice will become over time too, is that you will have word of mouth or direct outreach that doesn't, have an intermediary, and you're again working the same one-on-one with an attorney or firm. And those tend to be a little bit more straightforward. That doesn't mean there isn't, some value, especially in breaking through by participating in a firm that's gonna kind of be handling the business component of it. That may make it easier for you, and it may make it easier to leverage, the network that they have, especially if you're, really busy or full-time clinical.
Yeah. Let's shift gears a little bit. Emergency medicine is one of the most difficult specialties when it comes to standard of care and hindsight bias. What do attorneys often misunderstand about emergency department decision making that's different from being in primary care, or you may be seeing the same thing, but it's very different in the emergency department.
Yeah, I think, I mean, at on a global level, one of the biggest differences is just that emergency medicine is very probabilistic and based on doing your very best to rule out the scariest things and make sure that the patient is safe to go on to the next steps. And that next step may be coming into the hospital, or in most cases, usually depending on where you practice, 80%, maybe 70, 80%, even higher. They're going to go home, and you're going to make that decision to, send them out into the world and have a follow-up that, is at least days at best, and maybe weeks or longer. And so, you make use of these rapid diagnostics and, the availability to test much more quickly than in other specialties to immediately order something, labs, imaging, and try to risk stratify that patient. But the thing that I think is often confused is that are not fully 100% ruling out anything. You are probably getting down to an order of 1 or 2%. If you're following the standard and you're adhering to evidence-based guidelines, there's still a chance of missing things. And that's why, just because something bad happened, a bad outcome occurred, it doesn't always mean that there was a breach in the standard of care. So globally, it's that very quick, maybe 1 to 5 hours where you have time with this person and you're trying to rule out and assess for especially life-threatening situations. And it's, extremely dynamic, and you're acting and operating in each round on limited information, and then you have to make a final disposition decision. So that pace can be really challenging.
I think that brings up the thing is, emergency physicians often make decisions, as you say, with incomplete information. You've never met this patient before, unlike a primary care physician that may have a long relationship. And you're doing it under kind of this enormous time pressure. How should experts explain that reality? How would you explain that reality to a jury? If you're sitting there, you're turned to the jury box, you're trying to explain to them, you know, that reality, how would you explain it to them?
I mean, I think that it's, you know, it's helpful to kind of think about really just, you know, all the practical decisions that have to go into the end result that you're looking for. I think when people are on the outside of emergency medicine, they may see, okay, this person came in and it looked like they were septic. It looked like they were, you know, very sick with an infection. And at the end of the day, you know, for someone like that, we probably are going to want a panel of blood work. We may want imaging of various areas of the body. We may want fluids and blood cultures and a lactate and a follow-up lactate. And then we may want, you know, likely hospital admission, ICU admission. And that makes sense. That story makes sense. And the guidelines and regulatory goals in terms of taking care of that kind of patient with sepsis, you know, kind of just, you know, it makes narrative sense over the course of their visit. You're going to accomplish those things. But the nuance and where, you know, the reality comes into play is, How do you accomplish those things sequentially? How do you actually do that? You may have a patient who comes in and they're septic, and because they're septic, they're agitated. So you place an IV and they pull it out and you need to put it back in, or you need to put it back in with ultrasound. They're too agitated to go to CT scan. So how do you get that very urgent CT of their stomach, their chest, their head with them actively agitated? Well, you can consider if they need to be on a breathing tube and intubated and on a ventilator. That would be a very extreme example, you know, or maybe they need sedation or something to make them less anxious in order to facilitate that scan. But when you look at it outside, you see a person who is sick and you needed that scan to find out that they had, you know, a gallbladder infection, ruptured appendicitis, something else. But all those practical things go into actually getting it. How are you going to calm this agitated patient? How are you going to, you know, get them an IV and then get the scan and then interpret it. So all those contextual things, you know, go into, you know, what the reality is on the ground. And even more so, you know, in medical legal space, of course, you know, there's always the one patient in front of you, and that's how a matter is perceived and looked at in retrospect. But the reality of emergency medicine is you're usually balancing a panel of potentially 5 to 12 or even larger patients that are varying levels of acutely ill, and you need to attend to all of them, you know, somewhat simultaneously and move between rooms and implement the plan. So those realities and the operational constraints also play a big role in the day to day.
So when you're like reviewing cases or even in the ER, what do you see as the most common documentation or communication failures? Because a lot of that, you know, that tends to be where issues come up, documentation and communication. Mm-hmm. What do you see are the big issues within the emergency medicine field?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I would say that, you know, any practitioner of emergency medicine probably knows some of these situations pretty well offhand, where you tend to get in trouble. Like we know it as our day to day. It's the situations where you are, you know, frustrated or busy or very overtired or winding in your shift or passing off care, or a patient is not wanting to adhere to the plan of care that you gave them. All of those situations very commonly become disputes or issues down the line. And so I'm talking about situations where there's a handoff between two providers, and perhaps the second person, they may not know as much about the patient. They may not have the bandwidth or ability to get as involved, and something new may happen during that phase of care. So that can be especially challenging. You know, who is responsible for that when that pass off is happening? Additionally, you know, in patients who don't want to undergo the recommended testing, if they're going to leave against medical advice, if they're going to walk out of the emergency department, it's also a very high risk situation where you really need to talk to them and you need to document what you said about the risks and what you are recommending and what they're declining. You know, that often, you know, is a frustrating situation, and it can be, you know, it can be challenging to engage with those types of patients. And as a result, you know, that may not get that conversation may not happen as well as it could, and it may not be documented as well as it could. So that also, plays a big role. I think, especially though, whenever you get your hackles up of, I'm a little frustrated, I'm a little tired, I'm, passing off something to somebody new, or a patient is presenting a behavioral difficulty that's you find challenging. Those are always the moments to pause, and to take a deep breath and to know that you need to dial in more, that you're going to need
Those are kind
to
of
bring your
risks.
communication game and documentation game to those types of situations.
Yeah. For our listeners out there, they probably hear we're living real life. Josh is at home with a 5-month-old, and he's kind enough to still move through the with the podcast, even though he's being a dad too today. And so I appreciate that. So you're probably hearing his child in the background, which is, as a pediatrician, is always, I'm a pediatrician at heart, which is always great to hear. So Josh, at any point you need to take care of, sounds like your kid's pretty darn happy right now, cooing.
She's a
If
very happy one.
you need to do something to take care, you just let us know.
Thank you, Brian. Yeah, she's doing well.
So you've worked in clinical leadership and operations. As far as patient safety, where do you see where you've been? Is it physician driven? Is it system driven? Who tends to have more of the power?
Well, yeah, I think it is really critical to look at the context of where you're practicing. Certainly, like, we have a lot of control over the specific plan of care, the treatment, and the orders that we carry out in the ED. But as you point out, like, there's so much that is, the pharmacy policy, the nursing policy, how the hospital is structured, how full the hospital is, what units are available in the hospital that impact the way you then need to practice. And that's a really big part of looking at, expert witness analysis specifically. You have to understand and appreciate that context. I think, a really good example of, something that can be challenging in clinical practice and also becomes a frequent point of contention in a legal matter is something like a MRI, like a scarce resource that is hard to use, that can be slower to get, and is, potentially tied up, with another patient, or not available at your site, or not available at a certain time. And those system factors can really impact, how you manage. We all, as emergency physicians, know if you have certain kind of worrisome findings, like, weakness in the legs, or numbness in the legs, or bowel or bladder incontinence, then you're worried about the spinal cord. And the textbook, and the clinical practice instructions are, oh, you got to get an MRI, a stat MRI. What does that actually
One
mean?
question. Yep, as an
What does that
oncologist,
mean?
that's an urgent to emergent diagnosis. Compression time is damage. Yep.
Exactly. And I think, as clinicians, we all understand that, but then come the operational realities of how quickly can you actually get that MRI? If the MRI is occupied, is that study prioritized over other MRIs that are going to be done? Do you not have MRI at that time? Does your hospital have a policy to get an MRI on off hours to call someone in, or does it not have staffing or policy in place to do that? Do you not have an MRI at all? And do you have a transfer agreement with another place, or do you not have a transfer agreement and you have to look around for a place that's going to have that MRI and agree with your assessment of concern? All that context, plays very heavily into the clinical practice, and then, the subsequent legal matters in terms of what was appropriate and what was standard of care. Because it's not just you saying, I'm going to press the MRI button. It would be so lovely if that was the case. It's not that easy.
Yeah, I could see, the importance of documenting. Like if you're at a hospital, you think there's cord, we're taking this example, cord compression. You've only got a CT scanner. You don't have an MRI in the middle of the night. So I could see it being very helpful to say, I'm thinking about cord compression. I'm worried about this. The standard is to get an urgent to emergent MRI. I don't have an MRI at my disposal right now. And documenting very clearly. And probably people don't do enough of that, I can imagine. But if you document that really well about why you can't do what is not the standard, because the standard of care at your hospital would not be that you need to get an MRI. If you were at Brigham, you know what I mean? They've got MRI. That would be the standard. So the standard of care changes with location. But I think documenting, it just goes back. There's a theme that goes through a lot of these is documenting as much as possible, despite how busy we are, documenting your thought process, documenting what hindered things. Because without that, it's going to be hard to explain to an attorney who's deposing you, or eventually to a jury, what was going on at the time. And right? I mean, I assume that's a big part of what needs to happen in the emergency department is kind of explaining what's going on.
Yeah, I think, a lot of us in the day-to-day, it's easy to get caught up in kind of the routine of medical documentation, putting down the story and putting around what you're going to do. But over time, and especially in doing this work, I've really learned that, it doesn't serve a lot of value for me to, read off the labs that I got, because those are in the EHR and they're also in my notes somewhere down at the bottom. But what really, really should be in there is, the time that they, like we talked about with agitation, they ripped out of their IV and we had to replace that IV, and that delayed everything else that we did for sepsis, and it delayed getting the definitive imaging because we had to deal with access and we had to deal with acute agitation. Those situations where, there's a turning point or an operational issue or a communication, that's the stuff that really, really needs to be there to, talk about your medical decision making and the, the flow of the care and operational challenges that you might have, run into along the way.
So, I was reading over your CV, which is incredibly impressive. And one of the things that intrigued me was your, I would say, unusual background in science writing from MIT. I was like, whoa, this is really cool. I mean, we do a lot of writing with expert witness work. How do you think that's influenced your approach to reports, testimony, communication? Because you've got a master's degree in writing, but a very strong science background.
Yeah, I mean that was a wonder. First of all, a really wonderful program and a great experience. That I did right after college. It's a 1-year master's degree at MIT. It's a small program where you really focus on science journalism, the goal of translating scientific concepts for a lay audience and helping people understand complex complex concepts in engineering, in physics, and in medicine. And so at the time, my plan was still to go on to medical school, but it was a wonderful formative experience in terms of learning how to translate those concepts, how to write cogently and speak to others about complicated concepts in medicine and other areas. And so that's what I took away from that. And there's a lot of overlap that I found as I started this work. I was very, honestly, I was very happy, very excited to learn that those things were so intertwined. We're doing many of the same things. We're trying to communicate clearly. We're trying to do a good job constructing an objective argument, and we're held to that standard. We're trying to bring something objective, solidly structured, and honestly written, but in a way that translates to someone who is not steeped in that specialty area, that someone else can understand. So it's been a great tool over time. After I finished the program, I did some journalism as a freelancer, and I did a number of years of research writing as well. And all that experience, just communicating in the written form, has really informed this work. And I was very happy to find that that is a very big part of it, is interpreting and translating that in the written form. And so it's been a great asset in starting the expert work especially.
So, have you had some experience with depositions yet, or what's going on
Yeah.
at
Yeah, no, I, it's, you know, things that I've, as I've worked through, things, the, my, excuse me, the, some of the matters are starting to mature and get into that phase. You know, I've done a couple at this point. And, you know, that's a very different skill set, and it comes up less commonly, certainly than the report and analysis. But it is equally, you know, as critical to kind of ready yourself for and get comfortable with. I certainly would say coming into this work, it's an area where I was less sure, you know, of myself, that, you know, because I am a writer by training and a journalist, that I'm comfortable in the written word, and that is where I like to construct my thought processes and argument. And speaking on your feet is a very different skill set. But it's been, you know, I have started to understand and learn from those experiences, as well as times when I've been, you know, involved in a case or a fact witness in a case directly. You know, you simply do have to have the experience, though. You have to get on the bicycle and ride. It's a very unique type of environment.
Oh, it is. It is. What sort of, now you've got a few under your belt, what surprised you the most? Like, you know, what surprised you the most about depositions? The good, the bad, the ugly, I don't know, whatever.
Well, I would say, yeah, a couple of things. I think we all hold in our minds a notion of deposition and trial that is kind of pulled from a court TV and Law and Order and everything. So that was kind of a positive development. You know, I understand now that yes, there will be objections. Yes, there may be contentious points, but there's not quite as much yelling and crosstalk and shouted objections and banging of gavels as you would potentially expect. You know, it's a cordial environment where you're walking through, you know, your objective expert opinion, and they're going to challenge it and ask different questions. But it doesn't have quite that same ambiance, you know, as we perhaps rip from the headlines of watching too much Law and Order. The other thing that really surprised me, that, you know, now I understand a lot more, is that the focus may not be on your medical opinions or the medicine for a big portion, you know, of some of those things, the deposition especially. That I was definitely caught off guard, I would say, in one of my earliest ones, that they really wanted to talk about my website, how I presented myself, what I was expert in, what I billed for, what my bills looked like, what each line in my bill was for. And that took up probably more than 50% of the time. And that's something that you do have to be ready and prepared for, is that you're not just going to speak to the medical aspects of the case. You're also going to hear about, you know, whether they think that you are qualified to give those opinions, and why, and how you present yourself to others, what you've, you know, testified to in the past. So those are all fair game, and, you know, you do have to be cognizant of that going
Yeah,
into
they're
the
testing you. They're
depositions. Mm-hmm.
seeing how you react under pressure. They are looking for cracks or things where maybe they have some impeachment material when it goes to trial for cross-examination. And so, yeah, there are so many different styles. I could probably there are just so many different styles. There are people that come in and just want to know your opinions. And like you said, often the first half to two-thirds has nothing to do with the case. It's all about your background, your training, your experience, your marketing, your bills, what you reviewed in the case, and things like that. Going through emails that may have gone back and forth, trying to make you look bad. And as I repeat over and over, the deposition often feels like an oral examination that's open book with a professor that sits across from you that wants you to fail. You know what I mean? It's like
Very much.
that is sort of the, yeah. What do you see that you know, trends? What trends do you see in emergency medicine litigation right now, if you're seeing any trends?
Yeah, you know, I would say, you know, that what has struck, you know, stuck out at me as I've gotten more experience and seen more cases, is that, you know, there it's very common to see cases around things that have an established protocol or a time-sensitive kind of diagnosis. I think that's probably always been universally true, but as we've seen, regulatory guidelines, and that then get implemented in the hospital setting. I'm talking about things like how you manage stroke, how you manage sepsis, how you manage acute coronary syndromes, especially, those have, a natural tendency, not but just because they're high stakes diagnoses, but also because there are structure and appropriate guidelines that may or may not reflect specific standard of care in that situation. So I certainly see that in a lot of cases that I look at, that a high sensitivity troponin sequence and when it was gotten and how and at what times, stroke discussions, how quickly you consider or give T and K and get them, the imaging, and sepsis, in what order that you get the diagnosis or you start the antibiotics, get the fluids, get the blood cultures. There's more of a kind of an architecture of recommendations and guidelines to hang your hat on, when there's an issue. But it also, like any case, is still very, very context dependent. But I see a lot that are, heavily based on something that may have a protocol or a guideline, but then you still have to look at it, in the objective reality of that situation.
Yeah. Brought up your website. What is the, if people want to reach out to you, what is the URL for your website, Josh?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, if anybody is
We'll
interested
get
in
this up on the
chatting,
screen. We'll get this up on the screen too.
perfect. Yeah, no, ha happy to share, if there's, experts that are interested in, questions or perspectives on getting started, or if there are attorneys interested in speaking to me about a case, my website is emergencymedicine.expert. So that's the domain, emergencymedicine.expert. And you can click through right there and schedule some time with me.
Awesome. Any thoughts? I'm big thing that I'm intrigued about that I know I feel like I know nothing about is AI. Do you see anything coming as far as, and I've asked almost every one of the guests I've had on here because I'm trying to learn. I feel like I'm on the other side of the curve and knowing not much about it. Do you see, what do you see where AI is going to disrupt, improve, take away from this expert witness litigation support?
Yeah, and I've certainly encountered a lot of folks working in this space and thinking about how it's going to evolve. I think there's a very natural place for it, because there are voluminous records that need to be looked at. A lot of the contents of those EMRs, are generating, hundreds and hundreds of pages with not a lot of relevance. There's usually very key critical components of that are relevant to review. So I certainly see that there's a natural gravity towards, how could we collate and select out things more easily to get an assessment of merit and to move things along more quickly. So I've seen tools like that, like HIPAA compliant ways to look through the records, people that are doing AI driven merit reviews, in the early stages of a case. I think it's certainly something that I'm cognizant of, and I'm a big believer in you want to be understanding the trends and the trajectory. But you probably don't want to be on the bleeding edge of adoption, in that kind of case. But you do want to be, someone who is tracking what's going on, because I think it's still a very open conversation. What is appropriate and not appropriate for involving, AI in your own practice? I don't think that question has really been answered well. We know some of the bad examples, like hallucinated references and reports, not written or reviewed, by the person. But certainly there is a role for, helping absorb information, helping do reference and literature searches that you then, verify and validate is certainly a role. And even in, constructing and formulating the way you specifically want to, make a certain point. But you have to be, I think, very cautious about it, because obviously you're, someone who is the real human expert. That is something that the AI cannot be, but they do not know standard of care, because it is a probabilistic model that is feeding words back at you. You're
Although
the
they're
one that knows
working on
stuff
it,
that. Yeah, I'm sure. I'm
if
sure.
people have listened to listen to the podcast, we had a group on that is working on that is working on standard of care AI analyses, and so that's really interesting.
Yeah, I would say I think it's just a place to be, you want to be cognizant of where it's going and but cautious at how you use it. So you want to be involved and you want to be part of the conversation. But you want to be transparent and not be the first person to ever do it that way, because that could get you
Exactly.
into some trouble.
So almost out of time here. What anything you want to let the listeners know that we may not have covered or to remember about our conversation? I want to give you the last minute to kind of wrap things up.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. I would say, one of the things I'm excited, to do is to help inspire others to do this work and participate in this space. And I want to just sound a note of encouragement for everyone out there across, many different specialties. You are an expert. You've committed a very long road to the training and the knowledge and the practice that you've accumulated, so you can do this work. As we've talked about, it may be a little bit slow in getting started, but you have the skills, and expertise to bring that knowledge to bear and to provide opinions and analysis on the standard of care. And we really do need people, that are strong, in their field, that are objective and analytical, that are, you're not, when you're doing this work, serving a side, you're serving the objective clinical, events of the case, whether they favor one side or the other. So I would encourage people to get started and just try it out in a way that makes sense to them. And that could be a listing or website. It could be a referral service. It could be just talking to colleagues, or you may be lucky to stumble into it and have someone call you one day, even if you didn't even try to get involved in this space. But it's certainly something we need more, excellent folks in, and it's something that you have the credentials to do. So it's
I love the
so I encourage people
encouragement.
to start.
Yeah. I think if people are didn't listen to one of the first few intro podcasts back at the beginning, I would encourage you to go back. We kind of cover a lot of sort of getting into it and the nuts and bolts of setting things up. So go back to the beginning, kind of look over and listen. But Josh, this has been it's been awesome getting to know you. Getting to hear your story of how you got involved, your perspective. I think that's where what I enjoy the most about this podcast is just getting to meet people, getting to hear how they got into this, and the encouragement for those of you out there that are hoping to do this. You can do it. Listen, Josh, I mean, you can do it if you're patient and you don't think that this is, you're not expecting something big out of this, maybe for years. It could be a very slow process. I just encourage you and reach out to me, my contact information, if you want to talk more about where you're at in this expert witness world. And I just, Josh, thanks again. For joining us on the Expert Witness Playbook. And thanks for all of you listening to the Expert Witness Playbook. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, leave a review, share it with a colleague interested in litigation, expert witness strategy, getting involved. I'm Dr. Brian Woodruff, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.